What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Melissa Faye Green, author of No Bike Riding in the House Without a Helmet and The Temple Bombing. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I received some great comments about our last Too Jewish Radio show a week ago. People really enjoyed our guest, John Levinson, who spoke about the figure of Abraham in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and told me how much they liked listening to him. In fact, they said they wished they could have heard more of him. Not less of you, Rabbi, of course, the kicker, which always comes with every Jewish compliment. I mean, nothing against you, Rabbi, but he was really great. Of course, you're good, too. Boy, nothing like Jewish compliments to raise your spirits and make you feel better about yourself, especially the week of your birthday. You're good, too, huh? Rabbi Sam Kohan, you're good, too. I think I'll have it framed and put up on my office wall. Anyway, Dr. Levinson was an exceptionally good guest, as so many of our two Jewish guests are. And if I had a thin skin, I suppose I should simply get into another line of work altogether, or find a different religious tradition to embrace. Because with all the many fine qualities we Jews demonstrate, with our great accomplishments in learning, teaching, ethics and morality, in leadership and science and literature and entertainment and humor and music and even food, we are not exactly the most delicately sensitive people on the planet when it comes to worrying about other people's feelings. Let's be honest. Jews can be just a tad insensitive about minor matters like how they make you feel when they give you a backhanded compliment. We are a great people, but delicate emotional sensitivity is not one of our greatest strengths. On that subject, there's a famous midrash which teaches us that we should keep two pieces of paper with us at all times. One reads, "For my sake the world was created," and the other one reads, "I am but dust and ashes." We need to both remember that we have innate sacred worth and that we are humble, mortal, fallible human beings. Around other Jews, there is never a danger of forgetting the latter. But enough of my neurotic insecurity for one morning. I mean, we're bringing out Richard Lewis for the 10th anniversary of Too Jewish in a couple of months. That'll be plenty of neurosis for everybody. Anyway, this has been a fascinating, challenging week. Last Sunday, I participated in a memorial service at the cathedral here in Tucson for the victims of the January 8, 2011 attacks here, and on Monday, offered an invocation for the town hall held with national, state, county, and city elected officials. The goal was to have a civil discussion about political issues, and the emphasis was on the word civil, something that has been very hard to achieve in America of late. This was the second anniversary of the terrible attacks at that supermarket on the northwest side of Tucson that so severely wounded Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, an old friend of Too Jewish, and killed six innocent people. And with the commemorations and memorials here in Tucson and the connections to the grieving families in Newtown, Connecticut, and even Aurora, Colorado, comes an awareness that those awful mass shootings will keep happening until we address our serious problems with assault weapons and multiple shot magazines and mental illness. And the knowledge that we need to act now, unless we truly wish to see more dead children on the news. What we really need is a commitment to true peace in our society from all of us. And so to play us in this morning, here's a Sim Shalom, a prayer for peace, written by my old friend Bob Remstein, sung by another old friend, cantor Mark Childs of Santa Barbara, with his son, Daniel Childs.
Shim shalom tova uvracha, shim shalom tova uvracha, chen b'cheser v'rachamim aleinu, ve'al kol Yisrael amecha. Grant us peace, thy most precious gift, O eternal source of peace, and let us be messengers of peace unto all the earth. Shim shalom.
That was Shim Shalom, Grant Us Peace, from Bob Remstein, is sung by Mark and Daniel Childs. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, author Melissa Fay Green, best known for great nonfiction work like The Temple Bombing, will talk about her own experience with her family of 9 kids, including 5 she and her husband adopted from Bulgaria and Ethiopia. It's an amazing story. Find out why they did it and how it works in a few moments on Too Jewish.
There's nothing like a live radio show to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Too Jewish Radio Show, featuring Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends. It's live at the Fox Theater on March 2nd.
Better than Prairie Home Companion, it's Deli Home Companion. Join me and my great guests, including Richard Lewis, for a live radio variety show to benefit Jewish Family and Children's Services, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and Temple Emmanuel, Saturday night, March 2nd at the Fox.
Tickets at the box office and foxtucsontheater.org, or learn about sponsorship opportunities by calling 327-4501.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, author Melissa Faye Green, perhaps best known for her outstanding nonfiction works, including The Temple Bombing. She at a, I don't want to say advanced stage of life, but just when her oldest kid or youngest kid was about to leave for school, she and her husband decided to serially adopt. Her book called No Biking in the House Without a Helmet documents some of that experience. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning.
So let's talk about this decision. When you suddenly decided you needed to have more kids, you really went all out.
It actually happened when our oldest went off to school, not the youngest.
Oh,
the youngest
I'm sorry.
At that point was about six. We really had loved raising the children. We have four children by birth, and just we weren't ever the sort of people who said let's don't have a huge family. It wasn't like that. We were pretty much blindsided by joy, I would say, with the birth of our first, Molly, and just enjoyed raising the children so much. And then suddenly Molly turned 18 and was leaving home for college, and we had kind of this melancholy impression of empty nest at the thought of only three children at home. And, I mean, I go into more detail in the book. The book is No Biking in the House Without a Helmet. It's my first and only memoir. And it's humorous, but also there are difficulties there. So we knew nothing about adoption, but my husband tossed out one day, what if we adopt? And it was then 1998. I went down and typed onto my computer, and it was the old sort that made gigantic rumbling noises trying to log onto the internet. Then I went to a search engine. I think this was pre-Google. I think it was Ask Jeeves was the search engine. And
I just typed
in adoption. I knew nothing about it. And suddenly here are 750,000 websites, you know, flickering into view. And I went from knowing nothing about it to suddenly looking at images of children in Eastern European orphanages. They used to post their pictures there. And I was absolutely captivated. And once I started looking into these little faces, I found it hard to ever look away. So that was the beginning of it. And in 1999, we brought home an almost five-year-old boy named Jesse from Bulgaria. And that was the start.
You know, you have adopted not only your initial adoption from Bulgaria, but four from Ethiopia. That's quite a choice. What prompted that?
What happened then was we felt, you know, then we had four children at home again. Molly had gone to Oberlin College. But suddenly, our next oldest, Seth, was preparing also to go to Oberlin. He went to the Oberlin Conservatory of Music. My husband and I met at Oberlin. We forced all the children to go to Oberlin.
I was going to say, well, you must be like their alumna of the year.
Well, basically, yeah. They're pretty fond of us. And suddenly, Seth was leaving, and I protested. We haven't renovated the basement yet. You can't go, but there he was, and this was now 2001, I guess, and it struck me that suddenly the New York Times, other papers were full of the news of the HIV/AIDS pandemic across Africa and the AIDS orphan crisis, and I saw that the United Nations was calling Africa a continent of orphans. AIDS was just obliterating a generation. The UN was estimating within the next few years, there would be between 14 and 25 million orphan children. And so I read that as a world citizen, like all of us, thinking, what can be done? I read it as a journalist, thinking, is there something I could report here? Could I be of use? And I read it as a mother aware that we had a perfectly good twin bed upstairs that no one was sleeping in. I knew that older boys have the hardest time being adopted. People entering the adoption world tend to be looking for healthy baby girls, especially not African baby girls. So older sub-Saharan African boys were not necessarily what anyone was looking for. So I said to the orphanage, if you have an older boy who's kind of stuck there, let us know. And they said, we've got just the one, and told us about a 9-year-old boy named Fisaha. He came at age 10. Glorious boy. I mean, just the most beautiful, wonderful young man. He's now 18, looking at colleges, being offered soccer scholarships. One of my friends, when we were trying to find a title for the book, my across-the-street Jewish pal who had watched our family's sports fortunes improve dramatically with the addition, especially of Ethiopian children, suggested I call the book The Jewish Guide to Raising Star Athletes. And I thought that could be the title, actually, but the publisher said that was too narrow and niche.
Yeah,
but there is
a
chapter in the book that's called The Jewish Guide to Raising Star Athletes, and that chapter opens, all right, we admit it, we had to adopt to get athletes. So now we're up to 7 children, yes, 4 by birth, 2 from Ethiopia, 1 from Bulgaria.
We're going to have to leave that as a cliffhanger and pick it up when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish with the delightful Melissa Faye Green.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from our website, twojewishradio.com, or just download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Snow and hail fell in Jerusalem last week, and Mayor Nir Barkat called on visitors ready to converge on Jerusalem to see the rare snowfall to wait until it stopped falling, or so the news said. You know, accounts of snow in Israel in the winter always remind me of an experience I had in Jerusalem way back on New Year's Eve of 1992, fully 21 years ago now. I was a rabbinical student at Hebrew Union College, living in the Rehavia area of Jerusalem, and the afternoon of December 31st, 1991, it began to snow for the first time that whole year in the Holy City. Everyone was very excited. I was particularly so, and I dragged people with me to walk to the Western Wall, the Holy Kotel, so that they could see it in snow. A once-in-a-lifetime experience, I told everyone. We have to go. And although it was a cold, damp walk all the way to the wall, it was gorgeous to see snow falling on the Kotel Plaza. Well, snow and hail fell in Jerusalem. But you know, a funny thing happened. The snow didn't stop falling. And on that night of December 31st, 1991, New Year's Eve of 1992, the greatest snowfall in all of recorded history to that point drifted gently but steadily down onto the streets, roofs, and treetops of Jerusalem. Now, all around the city of Yerushalayim, there are magnificent Jerusalem pine trees, lots and lots of those great, tall trees in Israel that Jewish kids and parents all around the world donated to the Jewish National Fund to plant for every bar mitzvah and bris for generations. Lovely trees that had been planted out of the pennies and nickels our people had been putting into those blue collection boxes ever since 1904. And those lovely pine trees had never been pruned and had grown and spread out over most of the city of Jerusalem. Well, on that New Year's Eve of 92, as the steady, soft snow accumulated on the trees, the branches began to snap loudly, pop, 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 collapsing onto the electrical power lines below, severing them. And as we watched from our mirpeset, our balcony, the lights began to go out all around the city. Within hours, all electricity was gone, and a dark, frozen Jerusalem had returned to the 19th century. It was gorgeous, quiet, beautiful, very cold that night. And when we walked through the streets of Jerusalem the next morning, we had to step over fallen tree limbs and down power lines everywhere through a white, beautiful city of peace. It's a powerful, weird, wonderful memory. The funniest part was that it really didn't stop snowing for good in Jerusalem until Purim that year. And we never had any problem seeing the Kotel, the Western Wall, in snow until the very end of March. I trust that this week's snowstorm in Israel might not be quite as epic as that one 21 years ago, and that the water situation in Israel, having finally come out of 7 years of drought just last winter, will continue to improve when all that snow melts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
A little cold in Israel right now.
It is. Surprisingly, it is. Israel knows probably one of the biggest storms ever in Israel history. It is snowing in Jerusalem. It was reported to be snowing in Haifa, which was the first snow in Haifa probably since the 50s. Many parts of Israel got flooded due to the rain, including the main freeway in Tel Aviv, the Ayalon freeway.
Oh my gosh.
One of the results of this flood was that the entire region of Tel Aviv got into amazing traffic jams. People couldn't go anywhere. Many Israelis, in order to maneuver the traffic, use a phone application that tells them where are the free roads. Only that application had a bug. It saw that the Ayalon freeway is free, so it told everyone, go to the Ayalon freeway.
Which was instead flooded and closed,
and
basically.
Blocked, exactly. On other locations, there were over 200 homes that were evacuated due to the rain. There were rescue missions by the Israeli army that were taking place to rescue people out of flooded house, flooded cars that got washed away. Some of the people that were rescued were from Taibe. There was a home at Taibe, Arab Palestinians that were caught in a home there that was completely flooded. It was about 15 people were stuck on the roof, and a military helicopter of the Air Force rescue team was called in to evacuate them. Another occasion was with a car with passengers that was drifted away at a major stream at the Alexander River. Some reports say there were casualties there.
Yeah, a couple people drowned, I saw.
And the others were rescued in a complex rescue mission because the car was drifting along the river.
It's so interesting because people think about Israel as a desert, you know, in America. Of course, not a desert. It has desert, but of course, has a lot of other aspects. There was a terrible drought for 7 years in Israel till about a year and a half ago. Looks like that drought is not, it's over now.
That actually leads to one of the big debates in Israel today. There are two elements. One, when there was a drought, the government raised the price of water. So people are now saying, well, you raised the price of water when there was no rain. Now there is a lot of rain. You should lower the price. Now, of course, the government comes saying, no, no, no. The price of water is defined by the cost of pumping the water.
The desalination plants we had to build for when there was a drought and so on.
And so on. So, you know, they always find the excuse to raise the price. They never find a good reason to really lower it. So that's one of the issues. The other, of course, people say, well, why can't you make sure that there won't be any floods? Why can't you plan the system in a way that will make sure that water will flow through whatever they need to flow and not through the main freeway of Tel Aviv?
Excellent question. Somehow governments all over the world face the same questions. By the way, those pictures of Jerusalem in snow are fantastic. And I understand the mayor is saying, if you want to go there to see the snow, wait, because right now there's no way to get in or out of the city.
Especially if you come from Tucson, you can start going now. By the time you'll be there, it will be okay.
Sounds like good advice. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There was a very weird story, which I'll talk about a little later, about a guy who used some ashes from Majdanek concentration camp in a piece of art. It's a terrible, repugnant story, but it does raise a very interesting question about the whole issue of how the Holocaust, how the Shoah is used politically, artistically, aesthetically, now that there aren't very many survivors left.
Well, it's a very interesting, I think, very important and very complicated question, because in different countries and in different cultures and in different generations, the Holocaust is used. You chose exactly the right word. And so let's put used in very heavy quotation marks in different ways to motivate people, to inspire people, to cause fear, to warn people of various things. I mean, and let's take our country first. I think a lot of Jewish institutions, whether schools, summer camps, synagogues, temples, whatever, use the Holocaust in a certain way to motivate young people to know your past, to be, quote unquote, more Jewish so that we don't give Hitler a posthumous victory. I mean, we've all heard these lines, and I think there's an extent to which the fact of this huge historic tragedy is sort of exploited as a way of motivating young people to do what we wish they might do anyway, which is to study, to learn, to be more identified. And the line is used with shocking frequency of to avoid giving Hitler an ultimate victory. You know, 60, 70 years after the Holocaust, we don't want to voluntarily walk off into the night when the Germans tried to do that to us 70 years ago. And then there's Israel, where a lot of politics and political activity is motivated by either survivors or the children of survivors. Israel is a nation of survivors and the children of survivors, and the political leadership and the military leadership of the entire country for a generation or two was populated very largely by people who either themselves survived the Holocaust or whose parents went through it. So it is often cited in Israel in many contexts. But the most interesting, I think, and the most diverse sort of use of the Holocaust, and again, in quotation marks, is in Europe, where different political parties in different countries, different societies, all refer to this event in which they somehow participated or were victims, or it happened in their backyard, or it happened on their national territory in very different ways. And I see we're running out of time, so if it's all right with you, we can explore that range of actions and reactions during our next session together.
Absolutely. Fascinating topic. Thanks, Tom. We will continue this next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. It was a terrible winter night, blowing cold rain and sleet and snow in a frightful manner. The streets were deserted, and the local baker was about to close up shop when Bernie slipped through the door. He carried an umbrella blown inside out. He was bundled in sweaters and a thick coat, but he still looked wet and bedraggled and freezing. Bernie unwound his scarf and said to the baker, "Can I have 2 bagels to go, please?" The baker said in astonishment, "2 bagels? That's it? You came out in this weather for that?" "That's right," answered Bernie. "One for me and one for Bernice." "Bernice is your wife?" asked the baker. "What do you think?" snapped Bernie. "My mother would send me out on a night like this?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and stay warm. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Bo features the real Exodus from Egypt. The climactic text is familiar from satyrs and movies, but it is no less dramatic for its familiarity. Moses and Aaron warn Pharaoh that the final plague is coming. God then tells the Israelites to sacrifice a lamb and put its blood on their doorposts to protect themselves from the coming calamity. At midnight, the angel of death visits the homes of every Egyptian, from Pharaoh on his throne to the prisoner in the dungeon, and the firstborn male son of every household dies. Even the livestock lose their firstborn. After long refusing freedom to the Israelites, after 10 plagues and every underhanded manipulation he could invent, finally Pharaoh gives up. He literally throws the Israelites out of Egypt, saying, "Go away from my people." There's an ironic twist, the end of this freedom narrative in Bo. Even before the Pharaoh's fruitless quest to recapture the Israelites at the sea ends badly for them in next week's portion of Beshalach. It comes after Pharaoh has already ordered Moses and Aaron to leave the land. But before they can go, he says, "Be gone, but bless me first." It's a very strange thing for Pharaoh to say to his enemy, to whom he is now essentially surrendering. "Get out, now, but before you go, give me a blessing." There is pathos in this request, for Pharaoh has been an arrogant and magnificently stubborn opponent. Moses' request has been for religious freedom for the Israelite slaves, 3 days to worship God in their own Hebrew fashion. Rejecting this simple plea, Pharaoh has instead multiplied the slaves' work, reduced their supplies, increased their misery in the time-honored tradition of every union-busting tyrant in history, and now his combination of arrogance and egotism has brought death to his country and his family. Even Pharaoh's own eldest son, his designated successor, has just died. And now he says to his antagonists, Moses and Aaron, "Bless me too." Interestingly, the Torah does not record Moses' response to this strange request. Did he offer a prayer for Pharaoh? What is the suitable blessing for a brutal, genocidal god-king? Was it a mourning prayer for the dead son? Or was it more like the rabbi and fiddler on the roof? May God bless and keep the Pharaoh far away from us. Finally, after 9 plagues worth of direct evidence, the overwhelming power of Moses' God has become clear, even to this human representative of Egypt's polytheistic gods, a man who may even believe himself to be divine. And in that surrender, a little bit of humanity from Pharaoh peeks through. My gods are discredited, my blessings and curses overthrown. In my mourning, in my confusion, in my despair, I need blessing from my worst enemy. There's something peculiarly human about this, just as true today as it was over 3,000 years ago. For often in life we seek blessing not from those who support us and agree with us, but from those who don't. We long for the respect, if not the love, of those who are hardest to please and least likely to accept us. Sometimes the approval or admiration of our enemies even ranks higher in our estimation than the steady praise of our acolytes. As Jews, we know this odd motivation well. How often do we struggle with the need for approval from figures who do not give it easily? With the lack of unconditional parental love, the absence of regard from those who we most need it from, the near desperate desire to be accepted, all of these are so often ours. That is not to say that Pharaoh is a needy child, nor Moses an uncaring father or mother. The Pharaoh of this story is a megalomaniac tyrant. But apparently, even megalomaniac tyrants have emotional needs. A warped person still has human need for parental approval. Perhaps, especially in our time, in a story filled with drama and power, that plaintive request, "Bless me too," adds a human note. We all need to find blessing. Pharaoh never does, and regrets his weakening and chases after the Israelites to further his own ruin. But perhaps we, who have done so much less wrong than Pharaoh, and who need that blessing at least as much as he does, will be able to find it. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, the delightful, prominent author Melissa Fay Green, will explain how a sane, highly successful Jewish couple with 4 biological children decided to adopt not one, not two, but 5 additional children from all over the world, and find out what it's like to not ride a bicycle in the house without a helmet when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Our brothers of Israel.
This week, former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, a friend and favorite guest of Two Jewish, and her husband, former astronaut Mark Kelly, announced a new initiative called Americans for Responsible Solutions to work to encourage elected officials to stand up for solutions to preventing gun violence and protecting what they call responsible gun ownership. I particularly liked their opening statement in the op-ed they wrote. In response to a horrific series of shootings that has sown terror in our communities, victimized tens of thousands of Americans, and left one of its own bleeding and near death in a Tucson parking lot, Congress has done something quite extraordinary. Nothing at all. Kelly and Giffords go on to say that their organization will work to raise funds to counteract the gun lobbyists, that they'll invite people from around the country to join a national conversation about gun violence prevention. They'll support elected leaders who will stand up for what's right. They also said correctly that we can't just hope that the last shooting tragedy will somehow prevent the next. Achieving reforms to reduce gun violence and prevent mass shootings will mean matching gun lobbyists in their reach and resources. And they conclude, "We have experienced too much death and hurt to remain idle. Our response to the Newtown massacre must consist of more than regret, sorrow, and condolence. The children of Sandy Hook Elementary School and all victims of gun violence deserve fellow citizens and leaders who have the will to prevent gun violence in the future." Frankly, I agree with Gabby and Mark. I also sincerely hope and pray that this time we can work together all across America to change our society, our culture, and our laws and prevent any more mass shootings like Newtown, like Aurora, like Columbine, like Tucson. In other news, the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism of America, the congregational arm of the conservative movement, ran a cumulative budget deficit of more than $5 million over the past 2 years, renewing long-standing concern for the future of one of the movement's key pillars. The conservative movement's congregational umbrella organization reported back-to-back losses of $3 million in 2012 and $2.7 million in 2011. Over the same period, the organization, the United Synagogue, which is celebrating its centennial this year and has hundreds of congregations as members, although fewer than it used to, has seen a drop of more than 10% in its overall assets from $45 million to $40 million. United Synagogue's chief executive officer, Rabbi Steve Wernick, said the negative cash flows were due mostly to a handful of one-off events and write-offs. Not counting those expenses, the operational deficit last year was only about $1 million. We hope to reduce it to $600,000 next year and balance the budget the year after that, Wernick said. Still, the numbers are bad news for an organization that unveiled a much-heralded strategic plan 2 years ago to reverse years of flagging membership and declining revenue. United Synagogue leaders are rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic, said a senior executive at one of the movement's largest synagogues. Operating that far in the red is a big red flag. I think it's important for them to get their financial house in order. I think they would not advise their synagogues that way. True enough. Once the largest Jewish religious stream in the United States, the conservative movement has suffered through years of decline, brought on in part by an aging, shrinking membership, bruising philosophical battles, and most recently a string of financial losses. The movement's flagship institution, the Jewish Theological Seminary, went through two rounds of layoffs in the past 4 years to close their own multi-million dollar budget gap. United Synagogue has seen a 14% drop in its membership rolls over the past decade.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they tried to make me go to rehab.
And sadly and unsurprisingly, the second British inquest into the death of singer Amy Winehouse concluded again that she died of alcohol poisoning back in July of 2011. Winehouse reportedly struggled with alcohol addiction, which persisted even after she stopped using other illicit drugs in 2008. Singer's physician, Dr. Christina Romit, said Winehouse also suffered from an eating disorder, a sad waste of great talent. And while I wish I had more upbeat stories to report, I have to tell you that prosecutors in Poland have opened an investigation into reports that a Swedish artist used actual ashes from the Nazi death camp at Majdanek in a painting. Carl Michael von Hausswolf's picture was hanging in a gallery in the Swedish city of Lund until protests called the exhibition to close last month. Von Hausswolf said he had collected the ashes from the crematorium at Majdanek during a visit in 1989, held them until he thought of an artistic use. If the artist is charged with desecrating human ashes, he could face up to 8 years in prison in Sweden. It's estimated that the Nazis murdered 80,000 human beings at Majdanek, three-quarters of them Jews, during the occupation of Poland by the Nazis during World War II. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest, Melissa Faye Green. She's the author of Praying for Sheetrock, The Temple Bombing, some really fantastic National Book Award nominated nonfiction books, and then a very nonfiction memoir, No Biking in the House Without a Helmet, about she and her husband's, elaborate family, which we got up to, I think we were up to seven when we were speaking earlier, including adoptions from Bulgaria initially, and then Ethiopia, bringing some of the many orphans from Africa to Atlanta. Tell us about the last, I hate to put it in these terms, the last couple of kids.
Well, by the time we had seven kids, by then I felt finished. There was no more feeling of empty nest. I really felt set. Everything was working. Kids coming and going from college. This was great. When our third oldest son, Lee, the younger of our two biological sons, when he reached his senior year in high school, he felt restless. Enough with high school already. He wanted to see the world. We realized he had enough credits to graduate early. I said, "You want to come with me to Ethiopia?" Yes. This is when I was traveling back and forth, reporting the book that would become There Is No Me Without You.
Right.
So on his 18th birthday, Lee and I flew to Addis Ababa. And ultimately, I left him there. We had arranged with a foundation working with orphans. In fact, it's called Worldwide Orphan Foundation, that Lee would stay to play with the children. And he lived nearby and spent all day, every day, in three different orphanages, one for HIV-negative healthy children and two for HIV-positive children. These were all children who had lost their parents, and some were sick. He had the time of his life. He was ecstatic. He learned Amharic. He made friends. He had the most wonderful, wonderful adventure, adored the children. One evening that spring, Lee called home from Addis Ababa and said, Did you ever think maybe we could adopt again? And I said, Do you have someone in mind? And Lee said, two, actually, they're brothers, Daniel and Yosef. They're incredible boys. They would be perfect for our family. Please, please, it's like they're my brothers already. They're like my brothers already. So my husband, Donnie, was looking at me. He gleaned what was happening in this conversation, so he was watching me to learn the age and gender of our new child. And while I've got Lee on the phone, I simply lifted up two fingers to show we're talking about two. And Donnie burst out laughing. And I said, "Lee, you know, let us talk about it. I can't say yes right now. Let Dad and me discuss this. We really have to figure this out." And Lee said, "You will? You'll talk about it? Oh, my God. Oh, my. Thank you. Thank you so much." Click. You know, after he hung up, I thought, dang, I could have said no. He was expecting me to say no. So that was Yosef and Daniel, and they came in 2007 at the ages of 10 and 13. Daniel is also 18 now, a high school senior, looking at colleges. And also like our other athletic younger children, being offered scholarships for cross country. But now we're finished. People still say, nine, this is it. This is beyond what I thought we would do. But that's how we got to this point, kind of. One by one, by one, by one, by one, by one, and by two. That's it.
Well, it's an amazing story. And by the way, extremely entertaining book, No Biking in the House Without a Helmet. You're absolutely sure you're done?
Totally. We're done. We're completely out of bedrooms. We've been out of bedrooms since about 2008. You know, there's no, everyone's doubling up already.
Well, you know, we used to joke when we had our third kid, we had to shift from man-to-man to playing zone. But really, when you have nine, you're really administering a large or a small corporation in the house, aren't you?
Yes, but it's, you know, it's so much fun. We quote unquote save the last night of Hanukkah because it's rare that all nine can be home for Hanukkah. But this coming Shabbat, this coming Friday night, will be our last night of Hanukkah because our oldest daughter Molly from San Francisco will be arriving.
So you just kind of delay it until everybody can get there.
Right, and we do an in-house gift exchange. We do a, you know, Secret Santa, for lack of a better word, so that
Hanukkah,
you know,
Harry,
pick gifts for one another. Uh-huh. Oh, there we go. Okay, that's better. So that's what we do, and there are great bonds of affection among the kids, and like Daniel, who's our 18-year-old Ethiopian son, spent a week last summer with Molly in San Francisco. She's the oldest of our biological kids. All kinds of sweet, sweet closeness. In fact, the last chapter of my book, No Biking, I think it's called DNA, and it talks about all the resemblances among the kids, but it doesn't fall along strict DNA lines. Like, the big readers in the family are Molly, Seth, and then Helen from Ethiopia, and, you know, that kind of thing. It's fun. The Amharic speakers include Lee, our biological son. The Hebrew readers include the older ones who went to day school, and then Helen from Ethiopia. Three of the boys, well, the kids, the Ethiopian kids have all played in the Maccabi Games. I assume you have those in Tucson.
We do. We have them in Tucson, too.
None of our biological kids ever made a Maccabi team from Atlanta. I mean, Atlanta has a huge Jewish community, 100,000. They never made it. The Ethiopian kids simply sign up, and the coaches are like, okay, you're in. What sport do you even play? And so they totally beaten the gene pool here. And so the three Ethiopian boys, Fisaha, Daniel, and Yosef, spent last summer in Israel as part of the USA Maccabi soccer team and had an amazing experience and were able to walk on with a professional Israeli soccer team. They were invited to practice with them, and half the players were Ethiopian Israelis, and so they were all bantering in Amharic. The boys love, love, love Israel. So again, just a real, there's just been just real richness with this.
What a fantastic story. I have one last question for you. You know, you have written such important, really great and important nonfiction books. I met you through the temple bombing. Bill Rothschild, the son of the rabbi's protagonist, that book is a friend of mine. And Praying for Sheetrock, Last Man Out. So how do you write with all of this going on?
For me, the important cutoff, the important professional cutoff, and I toss this out to any parents in your audience who wish to be writers, is the day the youngest goes to full-day kindergarten. Because preschool, forget it. And those ridiculous programs, two-day twos, really? Can we not? Can we have five-day twos? I have to do two-day twos to make it rhyme, you know, and those years where the kids, the youngest goes to school, you know, Tuesdays and Thursdays from 9 to 12. There's no time to do anything other than just sit in the parking lot and cry, and then you bring the child home.
Of
so
course.
In those years, I was convinced I wouldn't have a career. And I, you know, adored raising the children, but the flip side was just feeling I was at a complete dead end and would never be able to write. And even if I got a break, all I wanted to do was sleep. But all of that changed when the youngest goes to full-day kindergarten, and now as soon as they go off to school, we've got five living at home right now, all in high school. In fact, the kids now, in case you're interested, are 15, 16, 17, 18, 18, 20, 24, 28, 31. No grandchildren yet. But they all go off to school, so I love a good Monday morning. I love goodbye. I love, you know, I love the fall. I love the start of the school year in fall, because then I can work.
It's a great story. I want to thank Melissa Faye Green for a terrific visit here on Too Jewish. You can find her book, No Biking in the House Without a Helmet, on Amazon and, of course, everywhere else. And what's your website, Melissa?
It's melissafaygreen.com.
It's an excellent website.
There's no
website, E on Faye.
Right,
F-A-Y.
F-A-Y-G-R-E-E-N-E.
Yeah, try Kohan with two O's sometime.
I know. The moment I saw it, I thought, okay, he's got the same.
I understand. Thanks very much, Melissa.
It was a pleasure, Rabbi. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be the outstanding scholar of Hasidism and Kabbalah, author, mystic, and theologian, Rabbi Dr. Arthur Green. Our playout this morning comes from three Russian Jewish tenors singing a great version of the best-known Israeli melody for the hymn Adon Olam. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Terem kol yitzir nivra le'et na'asa bechefzo kol azay melech shemo nikra ve'acharei tichlot akol levado imloch nora.